Well, thanks very much, Anna. So it's a pleasure for me. Normally I say it's a pleasure to come to this place and say hello, but I will say it's a pleasure to welcome you to my university. I've been here 27 years in the maths department, and a couple of aspects of my job which I think are particularly relevant to today. One is that I, for many years, have taught a module to undergraduates on how to communicate mathematics. And some of the things I want to tell you about today are things that we work through over 20 years with these students, who then go out into the world, often working with very diverse audiences. And the second thing is that I served on the University Diversity Committee, and dyslexia is a very important aspect of the work that we try to do. My view is that every single student is special, every single student is a VIP, and every single student is here for a great reason. And what we try to do with all students with all sorts of neurodiversity or whatever is have individual ways of working with each student, and I think you can do no more than that. But I want to tell you a little bit of a sort of story about mathematics and various ways that I found over the years of making it a bit more fun and interesting and hopefully more relevant to students with dyslexia. Now, I don't think I have dyslexia myself, but my wife definitely does. She's had a diagnosis all her life, and we often reflect on that and the way that we kind of interact with each other. And I did run this talk past her before I sent it off to Anna. My actual job, although I lecture to students, most of my work is actually spent on applying math to the real world and trying to make, hopefully, the world a bit of a better place. And for the last 2 years, I've been using mathematics to help advise the government about COVID, so that's what I've been doing. So why do we bother with maths? Why do we bother to communicate with maths? Why do we bother to talk to the students about maths, or anyone about maths? And that is, it's important. It's really important in our lives. Pretty well every one of you has got a mobile phone, and those of you who have a mobile phone have a huge amount of mathematics in your pocket. Okay, so a lot of maths has got into a mobile phone. And it is a subject which lies at the very heart of modern society, modern technology. And if we don't encourage people to be aware of mathematics, then they are going to miss out on a lot of things, especially with the way things are going as we head into a more data-driven way of looking at things. And I absolutely firmly believe that everyone can and should be able to access and enjoy mathematics. I don't think there is anyone who is not able to do mathematics at some level or enjoy mathematics at some level. Although I do appreciate that we all come to this subject with different abilities and attitudes. And one of my favourite quotes is due to this fantastic guy. If you've not met this guy, let me tell you a bit more about him. This is Ira Chamberlain, who until recently was president of the Institute of Mathematics and its applications, and is a fantastic force for good in encouraging students, particularly black students, to go into mathematics. And here's a lovely quote: "You don't need permission to be a great mathematician." It doesn't matter whether you're black, white, dyslexic, Asperger's, or whatever. You can be a mathematician. You don't need anyone's permission. And as I say, Naira is a brilliant guy and well worth having along to any event. And the reward for that, does anyone know who these two guys are? I bet you've all used their product today. These are the guys that founded Google. This is Brin and Page. Who came up with Google during a maths lesson at Stanford University in California and have gone on to utterly transform the world. Mostly in good ways. You know, Google is basically a force for good. They haven't basically killed people. And so in our departments, I'm very privileged to have in front of me when I talk students who I know are going to often change the world. I mean, it's true of all disciplines, of course, but here are two examples of two mathematicians. And if we have time later on today, I'll tell you a little bit more about how Google actually works. Okay, because we've all used Google, but I don't know how many of you know how it actually works. And it's not that hard to explain, and it's very motivating. So that's the reward. But here's the downside. So recently, there came out a some sort of thing came out from the Department of Education. So we shouldn't call maths maths anymore because it's too scary a word. We should just call it numeracy. And here we are, the star weapons of maths destruction. And the role and the fact that maths is great fun and very creative isn't appreciated. And I think that's across the board, whether not necessarily people with dyslexia or whatever, just across the board. There's this perception that mathematics is useless, that it's boring and logical, and therefore uninteresting to maybe students with dyslexia, that it's not creative. Nothing could be further from the truth. Maths is highly creative, and that's very much what I'm going to try to show to you. Maths is only done by white men. Well, we've just seen here. it's still done by more men than women, and we're trying to change that, but there's actually a lot of diversity in people that study maths. And that is impossibly hard. None of these are true. Every single one of these is a perception, which is not true. And I see my role and everyone's role as one of challenging these perceptions and welcoming everyone into this world where we use mathematics. So I did a bit of a search on Google, not very intensive. I typed in dyslexic mathematician. And interestingly enough, no women came up in this search. I'm not sure what that means. But here are four people who, according to Google, I'm sorry, it's not great research, are dyslexic. The one on the left is probably the most famous to you, Albert Einstein, who there's a great deal of research into his dyslexia. And yet, incredible creative genius, transformed the world we live in. The guy next to him is Clark Maxwell, who was the person that invented radio waves. Your mobile phone would not work without him. Galileo, who brought in modern science, has the same birthday as me. I'm very proud of that fact. And on the right, one of my lecturers at Cambridge, Stephen Hawking. All four of these had dyslexia. Probably Galileo, obviously wouldn't have called it that in these days, but I'm pretty sure he had. And all four of those have managed to overcome that and be incredibly creative and important mathematicians. And of course, Hawking overcame even more than that. So when I was at Cambridge many, many years ago, he lectured me. So I feel incredibly strongly that we need to challenge all these negative stereotypes, negative perceptions of mathematics, and show that we can unlock the potential of every single one of our students. So I'm going to think most in terms of students here, regardless of whether they have dyslexia or any form of diversity. Okay, so I passionately believe in that. Let me show you some students. Oh no, that's not right. I'll show you some students in a minute. So this is not just a view that I hold. So a few weeks ago, I was at a teachers' conference, and we asked the teachers at the conference, how could we basically, what are the barriers to learning mathematics, how can we overcome those? And they gave the following responses, which I think apply to all young people, regardless of whether they got dyslexia or not, but I think some of these are particularly relevant to students with dyslexia. I'm sorry this is a rather busy slide, but we tried to compress quite a lot of information. So basically we asked them to give us the top five things that would help to inspire the students. The biggest one was just being more positive. So to challenge the stereotype that mathematicians are scary evil gits, they're not. My daughter might disagree, but anyway. Secondly, to show that if you study maths at school or at university, that opens up a huge number of opportunities to you. 70% of jobs need some sort of mathematics. And if you do mathematics, your earning potential is higher than if you do certain other subjects. 41% more diverse role models. And again, this is very much where we come in here. Show that maths is done by people with all sorts of diversity. And greater promotion of STEAM, to think of maths as part of a broader thing. And 34% want us to think of ways of making more
hugely advised, of course, to students with dyslexia. So they're saying they want to work in a way that they, in a more open way, look at exploiting creativity, look in things in terms of problem solving, so various sort of flows that came out. So this was a workshop that we held at Cambridge in May, and it came up with these things, and I'm sure those resonate with many of you.
Okay, and here are ways that I think we can make math more accessible. Firstly, by emphasising that it's not a cold, logical, it is logical, but it's not a cold, dry, logical subject. It is a creative subject. It's a subject full of discovery and challenge. And I think those things must resonate with students with dyslexia, that they want to see the creativity, and we can exploit the creativity that dyslexic students have. Secondly, to show that maths is a subject which really is full of awe and wonder. Now, this is, I'm sorry, a bit of a scary formula I put up here, but this is my favourite formula in the whole of mathematics. I'll tell you why it's so amazing. On the left, we have the number pi, which is to do with the circumference of the circle. On the right, we have the odd numbers, 1, 3, 5, 7. We take their reciprocals, we add them up in this alternating way, and we get pi divided by 4. I tell my students, if that doesn't blow your mind, you have no mathematical soul. Firstly, someone had to come up with this. The tradition is that Newton came up with it, but actually it was known in India at least 200 years before Newton. And it kind of links all sorts of things together. It's incredible. And if we can get this sense of awe and wonder across, I think we immediately dispel the idea that maths is just boring and cold and hard thing. I just love that. And it's useful as well, because you can work out why from it. And then I say finding the links between maths and art and real life, and certainly also saying that mathematics is a people think that maths is, you open a maths book and it's all there, it's like it was kind of written by itself. But every single mathematical formula was invented by someone at some point. So maths is a people subject. Mathematicians, we don't have big laboratories, it all has to come out of our heads. And so it's a subject full of real life and full of real people. And finally, as I say, demonstrating that maths is fun and maths is useful. So these four things are kind of what drive the way that I try to teach, both to my students or when I go out and work with young people, because we run workshops, I'll tell you a bit more about this in a minute, and also we run other events for people where we try to demonstrate maths. So anyway, the greatest is great for me. Not perhaps the greatest form of the whole maths, but it's my personal favourite. So just to tell you some, all our people want to know why is maths useful. Here are some uses of maths. I'm not to go into them in detail, but if any of you've been into a hospital and been scanned, that scanner needed maths to be able to work out what was going on inside you. And in fact, a lot of my own research works on exactly that. So there are some. But that's only some. And here's a few more. Look at that. Did you know that Shrek isn't a real ogre? No. He's actually a kind of formulae. And Pixar, the company that created Shrek and all that, is stuffed full of mathematicians. And one of the biggest employers of mathematics is the creative industry. Okay, so Pixar's, the leading people in Pixar are all mathematicians. Why? Because you need maths to be able to create these shapes and move around. Okay, here's maths at use in industry and so on. It's in everything. It's in everything. So the number of careers, people think, oh, I don't want to do maths, I just end up being a maths teacher. Nothing wrong with maths teachers, but or an accountant, nothing wrong with accountants. But the world is really opening up. And so I just spent 2 years serving on a committee called SPI-M, which provided, SPI-M is Scientific Panel for Infectious Disease Modelling, providing government with advice on COVID. It's rather taken over my, 2 years. So there we are. Biggest employer of mathematicians in the United States is the creative film industry. It beats the security people and the banks. Brilliant. And here we are.
You too could be a mathematician. You don't have to be, you know, phenomenally brilliant. These are our, some of our students, and look at what a lovely diverse bunch they are. Okay. Lots of women, certainly not all white, guy on the right, wheelchair, you know, lovely diverse bunch. So these are Bath students lounging around in the lawns outside, wearing their Bath student t-shirts. Okay. So all of you can be like them. These are our, I should say, our graduate students. They're a little bit older than undergraduates, but wonderfully diverse bunch.
Okay, so how can you be a mathematician? So that's what I'm going to try and sort of take you through. I appreciate not everyone in front of me is a maths person, so I'm going to try to do some case studies of different things that I've found have worked in getting students of all types, and particularly students with dyslexia, interested in maths. Maths is above all the subject of patterns. It's the subject of finding and learning about patterns. And roughly speaking, the way maths works is that you play. You play with things, and you play until you find patterns, and then you try to learn about the patterns, and then you try to find if learning about those patterns can help you discover new things. So all good mathematicians play. I don't know if you noticed in the news a few days ago, we had the award of things called the Fields Medals. These are the biggest prizes you can get in maths. One of them went to a guy called James Maynard, who is at Oxford, who made big discoveries about prime numbers. And in his write-up in the newspaper, it said, yeah, the way I did it all was I just played until I spotted things. And I would argue that playing is something that students with dyslexia are particularly good at, because they have that attitude to life. So, or maybe I'm wrong, but that's what my wife told me anyway. And as I say, you don't need a laboratory to be a mathematician. You don't need anyone's permission. You can just get on and do it. So that's the theory. And what I want to do is whiz you through just a few case study examples. We will need a bit of audience participation at some point. Just warn you about that. But not to start with. Anyone here like Sudoku?
Yeah.
It's mathematics. Okay. It's not just because it's got numbers. You could do it with other things. But the basic ideas behind how you do Sudoku are mathematical ones. And I find lots and lots of young people, you give them something like this to do, and they just won't stop doing it until they've done it. I mean, particularly some of the more Asperger's are related students. So, as I say, maths is the subject of puzzles and games. So one really good approach, and this is essentially what the teacher said to us, is give young people something they can play with and puzzle with, and you've got them hooked. And then they can kind of learn the maths because of the way their brains are trying to do that. I don't know if there's any research on dyslexia and Sudoku, but maybe there is. But I find things like this do captivate and hold people. I can spend a whole afternoon on Sudoku puzzle and then find a main mistake. Here's another one of my favourites. When I started as an undergraduate at Cambridge back in 1979, these things had just come out. They basically wrecked my undergraduate career, particularly in the first year. But we learned a lot from Rubik's Cubes, and they're amazing things. I've given up doing these at science fairs, because I'd have one at a science fair, and every so often a child would come along, shut their eyes, do it behind their back, and it's all done, you know. Made me feel stupid. No, it didn't. The main reason I gave up using Rubik's Cubes in science fairs is they kept being people walked away with them. But the point about this is that I learned a lot of mathematics in my first year by playing with a cube. And I think this sort of attitude of play is a really good one. And here's another one. This is called the Bedlam Cube. And there's a thing on the internet by Jasmine, aged 8, she says, on how to solve it. So this is a three-dimensional puzzle. When I go to science fair, when I run science, by the way, Bath Taps into Science is the local science fair. We've cancelled it for last year due to COVID. It's coming back next year if you happen to be in the area. Again, this is a marvellous way of experiencing mathematics if you like creativity. And this is the result. These are random shots of young people that have come to my science fair where they have spent an hour at my stall trying to solve puzzles, and during which we have wonderful conversations, and the parents thank us for doing such a good childminding act. And these wonderful faces as they solve the puzzles that we've given them. So I can't say more than this. These sort of toys and playfulness is a fantastic way. You kind of learn maths by diffusion. You know, people say, "Oh, this isn't maths." It absolutely is maths, and you can learn all sorts of things. And so I hope there are some future mathematicians there amongst that lot. So that's one way of doing maths. Maths through toys, and that's part of the aspect of my talk.
Another thing I really like is
teaching maths through magic. What's the link between maths and magic? Well, maths has these things in it called theorems. Theorems are ways of basically bringing things together to give you truths which are often surprising. I put that thing up on the board, pi over 4 is blah, 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 blah. That's a mathematical theorem. So a mathematician, these are magical and amazing and wonderful. To the general public, they're, well, you know. But if you can turn these into magic tricks, then the magic tricks kind of bring out that awe and wonder, and then that's something which a student that's been exposed to that can learn from and start to enjoy the mathematics. These are two of my students doing a maths magic stall at one of our science fairs, and I'm not quite sure where they're from, but I think they're enjoying themselves. Right, we're going to do a first magic trick. Now, I hope this will work in a dyslexia type environment. I tested it on my wife, she said it's okay. Okay, so we will try. I should say she's a health worker, not a mathematician. So we're going to do a little bit of mental arithmetic and then see if we can do a bit of mind reading. Okay. So to do this, I want all of you to think of a number, a whole number, between 1 and 9. Don't tell me what it is, but think of it in your head. Okay, so I'll give you a bit of time to think of a number. Okay.
Right. Have you all thought of a number?
Yeah.
Right. Here comes the hard bit. I want you to multiply by 9. Okay. Now, if this is an audience with children, and I'd ask the adults to ask the children to do this calculation for them, but we're on our own here, so just take the number and if it was 2, 2 times 9 is 18. Okay. Have you all got a number? Okay, give me a nod. Okay. Take the digits of that number and add them together. Okay. So if the digits were 3 and 4, you'd add them together and you get the number 7. Okay. Right, we managed to do that. Okay. Now I want you to take 5 away from that number. Okay, so if your number was 7, you take 5 away, you get 2. Okay. Who's got a number? Brilliant. I can see your fantastic mathematicians already. Right. Now, okay. Now we're going to move a little bit away from maths. If that number is a 1, I want you to give it the letter A, 2B, 3C, 4D, 5E, and so on. Okay. So you get a letter corresponding to your number. Good. Right. Now, another challenge. I want you to think of a country that begins with that letter. So if your letter was A, you could think of Australia. Okay, so think of a country that begins with that letter. Now take the last letter of that country, and I want you to think of an animal that begins with that letter. A nice big sort of landy sort of animal, which begins with that letter. Do we have an animal? Good. Now take the last letter of that animal and think of a colour that begins with that letter. So we should have a colour, an animal, and a country. Right, now I want you to think those through to me. See if the airwaves can get there. Yeah, I think I'm getting there.
Hang on. Yeah, I think you're there.
I
think we're there.
And it's from Denmark.
So it's an orange kangaroo from Denmark.
Yes.
Did it work? Good. So I hope that's appropriate for the It's a lovely creative joke. The mathematics is that if you take any number between 1 and 9, multiplied by 9, then the digits of that number add up to 9. And that's the pattern. And you can get that by playing. You take away 5, you get 4. D for 4. Not many countries begin with D. You've got Denmark. You've got Dominican Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Disneyland, according to one score. And then you've got Denmark, K, kangaroo, O, orange. Orange kangaroo. This also illustrates another aspect of my teaching, which I use a great deal with both undergraduates and school children, which is the massive use of cuddly toys in all teaching. And one nice thing about, normally about going to lectures with cuddly toys, people say, oh, he's the lecturer, that's cuddly toys. The other advantage of lockdown, because we had to teach deliver things online, I did quite a lot of my lecturing using my dog. And that actually increased my student numbers and ratings. Well, the dog got the ratings, really, by quite a lot. So, yeah. Use of cuddly toys and magic. Let's do another quick magic trick. Let's see if this works. Pack of cards. Okay. Would somebody like to tell me a number between 11 and 19? 16. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. So the numbers in 16 are 1 and 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Now, do you like telling stories, telling jokes, things like that? You like telling jokes?
Yeah.
Would somebody else like to give me a number?
17.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Again, 17 is a 1 and a 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And again, I know you like telling funny stories, because you are a joker. Okay. Let me show you how not all jokers. So, there's a magic trick. And again, it's fun, and it's easy to do. What's the mathematics which it illustrates? If you take the number 10, the digits in 10 add up to 1. You take 10, 1 away from 10, you get 9. Take 11, the digits add up to 2. Take 2 away from 11, you get 9. All the way down to 19. Where do I put the joker? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Put the joker as a 9th card, and the trick works itself. Now, let me tell you how I'd use this. And again, you can use this at all levels, from primary all the way up to undergraduate or beyond. You do the trick. Now, if I was a proper magician, I could do it a lot better. My great friend Matt Parker, who's a mathematical magician, does it amazingly. You do the trick. You do it a few times. You generate the sense of awe and wonder. Unlike a magician, a mathematician will then show how the trick works. Okay? And then you ask the young people to think, well, can you find a similar trick based on the same number? And that's where the creativity comes in. And then when they thought about that for a bit, at the end of the day, you get them to all share the magic tricks amongst themselves. And that way they've learned mathematics, they've enjoyed themselves, and they've come up with great tricks that they can try on their friends later on and impress them. And I'm convinced that there's no barriers to that. I can't see that a student with dyslexia wouldn't enjoy doing. So,
magic.
Another thing I've found has worked really well is looking at the links between maths and art. Now, my daughter, who I've already been rude about, actually is an artist. She's a struggling professional artist, largely surviving on the bank of mum and dad. But she's got a studio up in Glasgow where she produces some ceramic art. So she's, you know, shown me how amazing art is. People think that maths and art are very different. Maths is cold, hard, and logical. Art is creative and fun. But actually, maths is creative and fun, and therefore art and maths are very similar. And they are very similar in the way they are linked together through creativity. And many students that I've experienced who are dyslexic love art. They're really good at art. They have sort of creativity which sparks artistic stuff. And so if we can link maths and art together, then we're on to a winner. Another thing about linking maths and art is that art is very international, very multicultural, and it shows the links, the multicultural links of maths, and that maths isn't just, as I say, done by white men. So I urge this. Now, one of my favourite links is through the medium of Celtic knots. So the thing bottom right is a Celtic knot created on a computer. On the left, we have a Celtic knot, which is in the Book of Kells in Dublin. And top right isn't a Celtic knot. It's a piece of African art called Somer art that actually has the same rules as Celtic art. I've been interested in Celtic knots for a very long time. I went to a conference in Africa to talk about this, and they said to me, oh, well, we've been doing this for many thousands of years before then, and there we are. So mathematical art. The way I kind of do this is I like to show students how to create artwork like this by following mathematical rules, but at the same time producing this sort of creative. So all of these things, these are four types of Celtic knot, all of which could be easily produced by following certain rules, and then you can explore the link between creativity, art, and mathematics. And I run a Celtic knot workshop, which is really a maths workshop in disguise, and we have such fun. And students produce such great things. And this is the equivalent stuff coming out of Africa. Just to show you how to do it, if you want to take something away, the way to do it is you start with a grid. You can mass produce these on a photocopier or whatever. And here's a grid of five horizontal, four vertical lines. The actual numbers don't matter. We call that a 5-4 grid. And here are the steps in drawing a Celtic knot. This is on a 5-6 grid. What you do is you take each horizontal, and at the midpoint of each horizontal line, you do a cross with the solid part of the cross pointing in that direction. And in the vertical, you do a cross with the solid point pointing in that direction. And then you join them all up, and you get these wonderful patterns. Now, that's beautiful and great fun, and you can let the students loose on that, and they will draw things in beautiful colours, and that's such fun. And then you can ask a mathematical question. And the question I ask is a simple one, which is, imagine that that's a fishing net made out of pieces of string, which it could easily be. How many pieces of string do you need to make that net? So that shows that maths isn't just 1 plus 1 equals 2, it's a discovery. Anyone like to tell me how many pieces of string for that one?
One.
Just one. Here's another one. How many pieces of string for that one?
One.
Try again. Pointer, I can show you. Maybe I'll have to do it with an amateur. So we've got, here we go. Here's one piece of string. There's one. Here's another one. Okay. Here's another one. And here's the last one. You need four pieces of string for that one.
And this leads the young people into a process of discovery. So you get them to draw loads of these things, and that might take a while because they can be rather elaborate and quite fun, and sometimes the students draw. And they count the number of strings, and they have to find a rule for how many pieces of string there are and how that links to the grid that they drew them on. And that leads to an investigation. And that's what maths is. It's an investigation. A process of discovery which you can do in your own time. And we find that students of all diversity just love doing that. Now, I don't know if any of you have spotted it. It's actually quite simple. Any ideas? It takes a while to spot it, actually. I wouldn't expect you to get it immediately. The number of pieces of string you need is the largest number which divides into both numbers. So if it's 5 and 4, the largest number which can divide into 5 and 4 is 1. If it's 4 and 4, then it's 4. And if it's 2 and 2, then it's 2.
Okay, so I should put that appearing.
And then I say to students, great, we discovered a rule, and now the really hard bit of mathematics is to show it always works, and that's actually very hard in this case. But that allows me to show how mathematics works as a process of discovery, and you can learn really interesting things. And let's say my friends in Africa said, but we know all this anyway. Because we've been drawing patterns in the sand which are mathematically identical to counting knots. The way these work is you put dots in the sand and you draw around the dots with your finger and you tell stories, and you come up with these beautiful patterns, and the number of times you have to take your finger out of the sand is given by the highest common factor of the two numbers. You can do even more elaborate drawings like this. So this is one of my favourite drawings. It's one of my favourite pictures of all time. This is called the Chase Chicken design, which we show the students how to do that, and then they can explore that, and then I see you can draw it in French lessons or stuff like that if you're bored. Because I've been reading about French lessons. But anyway, but these are the sort of things. Okay, so I'm running out of time. I will just whiz, say very quickly, oh, that's a quilting show, showing the same stuff. One of the other things you can do in maths with students who don't like sitting in the classroom is you can actually take them out into the real world and show them maths in the real world. And one thing I found works really well, this is my dog Benji, who appears in lectures. And we like taking young people to mazes so they can explore mazes and run around. That gives you great field trips. Or you can make your own one. If you ever visit the University of Kent, this is my friend Liz Mansfield showing off the maze that she built with her students to do that. So that's really good fun, making stuff. And I will just, in the last few minutes, talk about a practical application. So I did promise you I'd tell you a bit about Google. So I say Google is, everyone uses Google, and yet most people don't realise that Google was firstly invented by mathematicians, and secondly uses mathematics to work. And the basic principle behind it is very easy to explain and can be done with pictures. So I'll just tell you a bit about the maths behind Google. And this links up to mazes, because this is the internet. And what the internet is a load of computers which are joined together by links from one website to another, which form a sort of maze. So that's Google. And it searches for information on many websites. And the basic principle, go away, that behind Google is that if you type something into Google, and we're going to use the example of the pink elephant, if you type something into Google, it ranks the websites in order of importance and only shows you important websites. So that's the basic principle. So if anyone's using Google, that's what it does. And the key idea that our friends Bryn and Page of Google came up with is if a website has lots of people looking at it, then that website is more important than if not many people look at it. Okay. Now that mobile phone wouldn't work without mathematics.
Right. So here we are, we're going to have two websites here. One has one person looking at it, and the other has several. And one has a pink elephant there, and the other has a pink elephant there.
So you type pink elephants. So the question is, which one does this show when you type pink elephants into Google as the most important? So you could say, well, it's the one here, because lots of people link to it, and not the one here.
But you'd be slightly wrong, so I'll show you why. A website is important not just if lots of people link to it, but if those people are kind of important. So here is our pink elephant here, here's our pink elephant here. The website on the left has lots of links to it because it is the mascot of my students at Bath. Okay, so they kind of like it. But the right one is the favourite of this guy.
And what Google does is it will say, well, because David Attenborough is supposed to know a bit more about elephants than other people, and probably lots of people think that, this is the website which is in the end ranked as more important than this website. And that's how Google works. And I'll just show you how the sums work in a way which I hope will be relevant to any student, because they're not very hard.
So we'll get our, I apologise, my son animated all of this. What you do is, the way Google works is it assigns what is called a rank to each website. And if that website points to other websites, you divide that rank by the number of websites it points to, and you sort of give that amount of goodness.
So if David Attenborough has a rank of a million, and he looks at two websites, and each website will get half a million worth of goodness from David Attenborough.
So this website gives four to each of these. This website here links to two, so you divide four by two, and you get two. And so it gives two to this one, and two to that one. But this one here has already got four coming from this one, so it ends up with a rank of six. It divides that in half, the two it links to, so that one gets a rank of nine. And what's lovely is if you take nine and bring it across and add it to three,
that's 12, and it always works because maths does. And that's how Google works. It's very simple. It shares out its favours in a sort of democratic way. And that's the basis of the Google algorithm. Those two guys came up with it. They came up with it probably by playing around, thinking around. They came up with this great idea. They formed a company. They asked their professor if he'd join the company. The professor said no. So they went ahead anyway. And there's Google. And they're extremely wealthy. And if you do it, there's a slight catch that you have to do it for more than a few, a billion. But that's where they made their money from. Changed the universe. And all of our students can do that. So just to say, in final conclusion, these are ideas which I've found basically worked. I've tried them in all sorts of contexts. And one of the particular contexts we do is we run every Saturday morning what are called maths masterclasses with the Royal Institution and get a lovely diverse bunch of young people to come along. And these things actually happen all over the country. So if you want to give dyslexic students or people that you know will benefit from a really open and creative problem-solving way of doing mathematics, I cannot recommend these too highly. They're all around the country. And with that, I will finish. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris. Has anyone got any questions they'd like to ask?
Yes.
Most students' experience of maths doesn't extend beyond GCSE maths.
That's right, yes.
Which you often find quite challenging. Would you be willing to share your views on the current GCSE maths?
Okay, where do I start? First, I should say these master classes here, that we aim these for Key Stage 3. So these are for students before they do GCSE. Secondly, I have been an advocate for years. I wrote a long government report on this for making maths a subject that all students do up to the age of 18. And this is slowly happening. So the idea would be that we have three pathways up to 18. One pathway is the conventional A-level pathway. The other is for students that will be using maths in their career but don't want to be mathematicians, as it were, so someone say in economics or nursing or medicine or something like that, and that would be called core maths. And then the third is for students who've done GCSE but need more numerous skills, and that would be called post-GCSE maths. So that's what we've been advocating. It's taken a long time because, as always, these things require resource and an organised government to do. I have concerns about GCSE, of course, and that's one reason we do these masterclasses. I think GCSE is not a subject where the creativity of maths comes out properly, or a subject where the usability of maths comes out somewhere. And I also feel that good teachers are not given the opportunity to be as creative as they like. If we had enough good maths teachers, the problem would solve itself. And this is a difficulty we have. So the reason I teach communicating maths here at this university is to try to encourage more students to go into maths teaching. Or one of the reasons. So there are my views. We've tried to fix it. It's difficult. If we had enough resources, we could fix it.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's still hard to get around one-to-one support dyslexics for maths.
Yeah.
I've taught maths to dyslexics, you know, mainly over.
Yeah.
You could have a high performing individual professional, but they've only got these two skills, adding and subtracting.
Yes.
They've never gone beyond it, so break down for it.
Mm.
So we're building the other skills,
application.
Yeah. You know, the example you gave there, I was doing, I thought, well, I know many dyslexics who are high performing in many ways,
yes,
in maths. They may not know their tables, they maybe know automaticity with multiplication,
mm-hmm,
it's 7/8, it's fair, you know, it could be anything,
yeah,
to them, it's a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about someone who's a lawyer or something.
Sure.
And so, you know, there's still this blind spot where you have to really do the assessment, I mean the full dyslexia,
mm-hmm,
assessment, so what I would do.
Yeah. I'm
and then look at, you know, the individual skills,
mm-hmm,
the breakdown point.
I certainly agree, one-to-one support
one
is,
to one,
if you can do it.
Yeah, which, you know, in that large environment, it's not necessarily,
yeah,
conducive to the individual learning needs on maths in particular. It's probably the hardest area often,
mm-hmm,
just to get, well, I have got a lot through O-level, but it's the hardest ever achievement, believe me,
mm,
given their barriers, you know.
Chris, do you have any techniques for teaching times tables? What's your approach? What would be your approach? The kids are really struggling.
I confess I mostly use a calculator. I mean, I don't be afraid to use a calculator. There's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I learn mine in the traditional way of lots of practice.
Mm.
And I say to kids, people are very happy to practice to do the piano, or very happy to practice to be good at football. So some things just need practice.
That's a good point.
There's no quick way around that. But it's the other thing, there's no point in doing log division when you can do it on a calculator.
Mm.
And there's nothing wrong with that, I feel.
Mm. Sorry, there were some other hands up.
Yeah. I've found that, going back to the GCSE, I've found that many of the GCSE papers, depending on the exam board, are incredibly wordy, which then poses a huge problem,
yeah,
for a dyslexic.
Yeah.
My daughter has just finished her third retake,
yes,
of GCSE, very dyslexic. something she will never go beyond a level two, grade two at. They did change the exam board so that it was less wordy.
Yeah.
But how would a lot of the exam boards get around that? Because she's better, she can do algebra and things like that, that's sort of a pure maths, but she can't go, Jane went to the shop and bought 9 pencils at 10 pence each,
yeah,
can't do it.
Interesting. They've got wordier over the years, I said, and we've been told to make wordies make them easier. So,
but then there was a question in the maths paper this year, I think it was AQA, I'm not quite sure, that had people scratching their heads and saying, what is it? And when my eldest daughter did it 6 years ago, they scrapped one of the questions because it was ridiculous.
I wonder whether, there are other, thing, there's an operation called the United Kingdom Math Trust that does lots of what call math challenges, which are very math questions which are very unworthy. So if you wanted to, so
what's that called?
UKMT, I used to be chair of it, so I'm a little bit biased, but if you go onto their website, there's lots and lots and lots and lots of examples of non-worthy questions. And then math challenges. UKMT.
Math challenges.
Yes, so I'll explain. So United Kingdom Maths Trust runs things called Maths Challenges for students from 11 upwards.
Because I also teach entry level maths, because I work in a sense school.
Yeah.
And a lot of our students can do the pure maths. They're not necessarily dyslexic or they will be on autistic spectrum, but they can't, once they get to the wordy problems, that it all falls apart.
I can
surely, there were 10
cars
in the car park, 6 of them
are
blue, and they just can't.
UKMT problems are not wordy in their field maths, so I think they might be more suitable for adoption.
But when our maths papers go on to reflect that, I don't think I've got a crystal ball, but
I can't answer
just,
that question very easily.
It's just
I find examples really hard to change.
Can I just say something on that? Some of my pupils have got exam access arrangements where they are allowed separate space and they can read wordy questions out loud, and that really helps them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have readers because it's ours, it's the same school, so they all have their sort
of. Well, can I say we also have the same here at university? So if a student is dyslexic and would benefit from the extra time and, as you say, the space, they get it.
We also, going back on that, we also can't say any of the words, we can't say any numbers or symbols. So we could read the question out, but it could be this number, this symbol, this number, and that's all we can say. We can't say anything because we're not allowed to say the numbers or the symbols.
But I'm still interested. I mean, of course, there are other subjects, like, background and geography, which are very wordy questions. How do you deal with that? I mean, certain examples, I was saying, for example, like the Oxford and Cambridge board, whatever they are.
I think that's what my daughter did when she first did her GCSE, because I think they were doing Pearson, which was incredibly worthy.
Yeah.
I think it was Pearson. And they put her onto that one.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she did forget that she got
so it. So it is interesting what you say, because I say we've been told to make them more wordy to make them more approachable. So you can make it difficult to read, isn't it? Look at UKMT, because it's fast. It works with a million young people.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chris. That was really interesting.
Thank you.